This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. President Ibrahim Raisi says that Iran is determined to end the war of sanctions that the U.S. has waged on the country. The Yemeni army conducts a strike as a warning against the illegal shipment of Yemeni oil by the Saudi-led coalition. Plus, Russia says it has repelled Ukraine's attempt to break through its line of control in the southern Ukrainian region of Kherson. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. President Ibrahim Raisi says that Iran is determined to win the sanctions war imposed by the U.S. and other adversaries, citing a 13% growth in non-oil exports this Iranian fiscal year. Raisi says those who have enforced sanctions against Iran aim to prevent the country from achieving any growth, producing or exporting anything. He says the U.S. Treasury Department has created numerous obstacles for Iranian exporters around the globe, as enemies want Iran to be a mere consumer. But Raisi stressed that Iranian manufacturers and businessmen are determined to promote exports now that demand is rising for quality Iranian-made products, including military hardware. He says that this has angered Iran's enemies who don't want the country to grow and to capture markets. Iran has condemned what it calls contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says American authorities continue to exchange messages with Tehran, while at the same time fan the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argues that U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in an effort to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were an apparent response to statements by U.S. authorities who announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdullahian rejects this and says it is a priority for the Americans to reach an agreement, and they want that as soon as possible. The foreign minister stressed that Tehran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. However, he added that Tehran will not leave the negotiating table. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns Israel's recent airstrikes against Syria. The Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem believes the attacks are in line with the regime's continued crimes against Palestinians. He stressed that Hamas is standing by Syria in the face of the Israeli aggression. Hazem Qassem said the resistance movement would continue to develop and strengthen relations with Syria. He added that Israel's increased aggression in the region aims to put pressure on active resistance groups and prevent them from supporting the Palestinian cause. The Hamas official argued that Tel Aviv's normalizing ties with some Arab states is meant to push the same agenda. Comments came hours after Israel launched a missile strike into the vicinity of Damascus. Syria says its air defenses have shut down most of the missiles. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That is according to a report by the UN Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. The commission is now pushing for the issue to be referred to the International Court of Justice. However, it remains unclear whether the report will change Israel's behavior when it comes to violating Palestinian rights.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this. The chair also further added, unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless. The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank.
Israel has a long record of violating human rights and international law. However, the UN has, in most cases, just expressed concern over those violations. Now, the newly released report by the UN Rights Commission seems to be a rare instance of the world body taking a firm stance against Israel. Yet it's a matter of time on how Israel would respond, as the regime has shown in the past that it has no respect for UN measures.
The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that sees Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Yemen's army says it has carried out a drone attack on a southern oil port to warn the Saudi-led coalition against plundering the country's resources. The army spokesman says what he called the basic warning strike was aimed at preventing a tanker from looting Yemeni crude through an oil terminal in Hadramaut province. Yahya Sari says the vessel violated a ban on the transfer and export of Yemeni oil products. He also vowed more such strikes to prevent the plunder of the country's oil wealth. This is the first such incident since the UN brokered truce between Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement and the Saudi-led coalition came to an end earlier this month. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. The correspondent Yusuf Mowry says the Saudi-led coalition keeps plundering Yemen's oil wealth, despite an agreement signed to settle the issue.
Well, yeah, the peace agreement basically ended military activities on paper. However, you still have much of Yemen's natural resources being looted by foreign nations under the government of the Saudi-backed government, right? So what you basically have here at play is a corrupt government being backed by Saudi Arabia that's basically selling Yemeni oil and gas to foreign companies, most of which reside in Europe, and they're basically selling the natural resources, gas and oil, below international market price, and they're basically, these corrupt officials are making money under the table. And the message being delivered here by the Sana'a government is, enough is enough, the game is over, no longer will Yemen allow its natural resources to be looted by foreign nations because of corrupt government officials being backed by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition. And this is why the Sana'a government launched these two bomb-driven drones which targeted the terminal in the port of Adaba to basically send a message that if this Greek oil ship loads any oil or gas resources onto the ship, it's going to be targeted.
Russia says it has repelled an attack by the Ukrainian military to break through the border in the southern Kherson region, where it is evacuating civilians in anticipation of a counteroffensive.
The enemy attempt to breach the Russian troops' defenses by sending up to 2 battalion tactical groups on the west side of the Kherson region. All attacks were repulsed. The enemy was pushed back to their initial positions.
Konashenkov added that Ukraine's offensive aimed at a number of settlements on the west side of the Dnieper River. Russia has been under pressure in Kherson as it braces for a Ukrainian push to retake the region. Authorities in Kherson have called on residents to immediately leave the city. The commander of Russian forces in Ukraine has described the military situation in those areas as tense and difficult. He says Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings in Kherson. Since late August, Ukraine has recaptured hundreds of kilometers in its counterattacks. Kiev says that Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackouts across Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidency says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. More than 670,000 of them are in the western region of Khmelnytsky. According to Ukraine's energy minister, Russian air attacks have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10. As much as 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%. Energy authorities believe the voluntary measures are not enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, our reporter Johnny Miller investigates allegations that the Ukrainian army is killing pro-Russian civilians in areas that it retakes.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes.
They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses.
I didn't see it personally, but there were men fleeing from Krasny Liman on bicycles. As there was no petrol, they told me the Ukrainian army could do anything there. Shoot people down, cut them if they didn't like what you said. And that's why I left my grandmother's. I told them I couldn't stay and that I was leaving.
We fled to the side we wanted. I lived in Ukraine. I'm not against Ukraine. I'm against its government. We are all scared. If Ukraine controls my town, I won't be able to return. We'll have to look for somewhere else or go to Russia.
Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly.
While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years.
While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The former British Finance Minister Rishi Sunak has qualified to enter the race for Prime Minister as former Premier Boris Johnson begins to launch his political comeback. Johnson rushed back to the UK from holiday to join the race and to jockey up support from Conservative lawmakers in Parliament. Rishi Sunak has already gained the minimum support needed to formally contest the UK's top job. However, opposition politicians and even some in Johnson's own party say that they have lost confidence in Johnson. The former premier resigned in September following a Tory revolt over a slew of scandals and allegations of misconduct. He was replaced with Liz Truss, who stepped down on Thursday amid growing calls for her resignation over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. A new survey has found that millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they struggle with the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show that inflation has returned to a 40-year high after food prices soar.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saipur is up, London.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traore took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with the insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it, because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted the coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased, over time, discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri Damiba is planning a counter-offensive from a French base. Protesters have come out in support of the new military leader, while condemning the ousted ruler, who they accused of being a puppet of France.
Traoré, capitaine! Traoré, capitaine!
Damiba is pro-français.
Damiba is pro-French. He has destroyed Burkina Faso. But thanks to God, we have a great strong man like Ibrahim Traoré to save us all.
Protesters in Burkina Faso have openly expressed support for Russia. Burkina Faso is now turning into a theater of struggle for control between Russia and France and the West in general.
I think, you know, Burkina Faso and this whole region of the Sahel in general is beyond a theater of struggle between Russia and the West. I think this is also a region where there's a heightened dissatisfaction with a long neocolonial system that has been run by France and French allies like the United States and the other NATO countries for a very, very long time. So we see not just here in Burkina Faso, but also we mentioned Mali, but we can talk about Chad. We can talk about protests in Niger. We can even talk about protests in Senegal. We see this whole movement trying to get France out of the Sahel.
Now, we have seen protesters expressing displeasure with the regional bloc ECOWAS after military takeovers in West Africa. Now, is ECOWAS realistic in its approach to coups in the region?
You know, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy within ECOWAS right now. You know, we understand that the goal of ECOWAS and what it promotes are what they claim to be free and fair elections, a certain style of democracy that is encouraged in the region. But we also see some of these people who are taking the most anti-coup stances, like out of Senegal and out of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, who are also constantly under surveillance by the people themselves because of this constant threat of taking illegal third mandates, unconstitutional third mandates to stay in power and to prolong their own positions. So there's kind of this hypocrisy where, on the one hand, ECOWAS is very pro sort of this Western style bourgeois democracy, but on the other hand, also violates that whenever it's convenient for certain neo-colonial factors to stay in power. What is really damaging on ECOWAS's part are when the sanctions are issued in cases like what happened against Mali, because that's not even just targeting the Malian government, that's hurting the people.
The recent events in Burkina Faso are almost similar to what happened in neighboring Mali, where anti-French sentiments run high. The government in Mali believes France is still interfering in the internal affairs of this country, including backing terrorist groups.
I really encourage everybody who is listening to this to go and listen to what Prime Minister Maiga said at the United Nations General Assembly. The accusations against France by the Malian authorities are really quite grave, really quite serious. Beyond just supporting the former president of Mali, we are hearing about the violation of Malian airspace with drones and fighter jets. We are hearing accusations that France has supplied terrorist organizations with arms and ammunition, as well as intelligence information. There was support on France's part of ECOWAS sanctions against Mali as a result of the anti-French government that's currently in power and currently seized power.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2022, the Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly terrorist groups. Now, how will the instability in Burkina Faso impact on the regional struggle against terrorism in the wider Sahel region?
Well, I think more and more people are understanding that this question of terrorism and this question of neocolonialism are not separate questions, but we have to understand what the roots are of terrorist activity is in this region of the world. I already mentioned the way that the NATO invasion of Libya impacted the Sahel. That led to a huge availability of arms flowing into the direction of the Sahel region. And this is something that people are increasingly aware of. And then, you know, we are talking about the role of France in also helping to sustain some of this terrorist activity, according to what the Malian authorities are currently alleging. And so I think that, you know, there's different ways to look at this question. Stability, we see this as typically a positive thing, but we have to understand that, you know, stability is not always necessarily positive. If it's necessary to disrupt the system that exists a little bit for a period of time, if that means some form of instability, as long as we can bring that to a place of organization and to a popular form of government, then that's welcome. But what's not welcome is a very stable, long-term neo-colonial system that completely exploits the African people for the benefit of France and for the benefit of Europe.
Well, our guest there says instability, which ushers in a popular government, is preferable than a stable neo-colonial system. I'd like to thank Inem Richardson for her incisive analysis today. We shall now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the patronizing remarks by the U.S. climate envoy, which angered many in Africa. Stay with us.
Carrie Angers Africa. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States climate envoy John Kerry has angered many in Africa after arrogantly stating that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects in the continent. Speaking on the sidelines of an African government ministers' conference in Dakar, Senegal last month, Kerry claimed the world is transitioning to renewable energy and that will not be in the interest of Africa investing in gas projects.
Gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Now, to discuss these annoying remarks by John Kerry, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, who is an African team member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can we say the assertion by Kerry that Africa should not invest in long-term gas projects is condescending and imperialistic?
I think so. Especially since Kerry is representing the U.S. imperialist state. U.S. imperialism is the greatest threat to life on the planet. It's a force of ecological devastation and disaster. It impacts not only human beings, but also our non-human neighbors and relatives. In fact, you know, the U.S. military is the largest force of ecological devastation that the world has ever known. It's, you know, been robbed through atomic bombs, toxic waste, and untreated sewage that's been dumped by over 800 military bases in over 80 countries. The U.S. Department of Defense actually consumes more oil than any institution in the world. And in the year 2017 alone, the U.S. military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is a carbon footprint greater than of most nations worldwide.
Mohammed Ibrahim, a leading African philanthropist, accused developed countries of hypocrisy in warning Africans against developing natural gas reserves while also eyeing such investments in response to the energy crisis in Europe.
Europe is wallowing in gas. Germany uses a lot of gas. Russian gas, actually half of African gas is exported to Europe. And then we have 600 million people without power. And people say, no. You cannot use gas here. This is morally bankrupt. It's just, that's immoral.
Many African analysts have echoed Mohammed Ibrahim's sentiments, saying efforts by Western powers to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa are the height of hypocrisy.
It's the height of hypocrisy, those efforts to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa, since many of the wealthy countries behind those efforts, like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, include natural gas in their own multi-decade plans to transition to clean energy. Belgium, for example, has doubled its natural gas usage since 1990 and has plans to build even more gas-to-power capacity in the coming years.
While Africa has contributed negligibly to the changing climate with just about 2-3% of global emissions, it stands out disproportionately as the most vulnerable region in the world. Now, this is while, according to Carbon Brief's analysis, the United States is the highest contributor to cumulative carbon dioxide emissions in the world since 1850. Now, Kerry denied that the West and developed nations bear responsibility for climate change and urged every country to bear the burden of its impacts. How true is this statement?
It's not very true. The African continent and much of the third world is already bearing the brunt of climate change, while much of the West, is relatively protected in some cases, right? And the African continent hardly produces any greenhouse gases despite all of that. African people and Africa's non-human inhabitants are paying a heavy price for the environmental crimes of foreign lands like the U.S., like, you know, France and the U.K. and Japan and others. One resident of the United States has the same climate footprint as 27.5 Senegalese people.
The West is insisting that Africa forgoes the gas, oil, and coal at its disposal due to climate change. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, speaking recently at the country's independence celebrations, slammed European Union Parliament for demanding that the country should halt its East Africa crude oil pipeline project.
Recently, there was yet another manifestation of imperialistic arrogance and hegemonism by elements in the European Parliament, whereby they decreed from Brussels that East African crude pipeline should not be constructed until those arrogant actors permit us to do so.
The insistence by U.S. climate envoy John Kerry and the EU Parliament that African countries should halt their fossil fuel development projects is seen by many as a deliberate attempt by Western countries to prevent Africa's industrialization, which will eventually stop over-reliance to the West.
I think we should note that it's not just industrialization that caused climate change. It's really the extractive practices of multinational corporations, largely based in the West, and the devastation of, you know, Western militaries, and particularly those like the U.S. military that brought about climate change. And so the false narrative that, you know, the West is trying to push helps them argue that Africa and a lot of the third world should forgo industrialization. And that's basically a death sentence for African countries.
Delegates from over 50 countries participated in a pre-COP27 meeting held in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Climate activists praised the progress made and want to make sure that previous promises are kept. The country's environment minister said that Africa must be allowed to exploit its resources.
The 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as the COP27 Summit, will be held at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in November. Now, what's your projection on this meeting? Are we going to see major split between the West and Africa?
And the success of that domination has always depended on the complicity of an intermediate class of the colonized. Those forces represent a central pillar of the colonial order. They're really just servants to, you know, their imperialists or neocolonial masters. And so for that to change, there has to be some sort of serious class struggle on the African continent against these servants we call, you know, heads of state and their contemporaries, the compradors, the African ruling class. And I think without that class struggle, there won't be a major split at the COP27 summit. There'll only be minor statements of grievance, like we're seeing, you know, today with certain folks kind of speaking out.
Now, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has expressed readiness to work with other willing partners in the country's oil pipeline project after the European Union expressed opposition to the development of the country's oil resources. Let's take a listen.
East Africa, therefore, should not worry about those arrogant people, that those arrogant people can stop the oil project in East Africa. If any actor tries to delay our project, we shall decisively deal with that betrayal according to the relevant laws. We shall develop all the aspects of the project with willing partners. Initially, I was not interested in the pipeline. I was only interested in the refinery to produce petrol, diesel, aviation fuel for East African market. It is Total who insisted, even when Uganda had to give away US $20.7 per barrel to use the pipeline. In the end, we support the pipeline because it contributes something modest to our Tanzanian sisters and brothers who, under Mwalimu's leadership, contributed so much to Africa, including Uganda, in the anti-colonialism effort. Besides, the pipeline corridor provided by the Tanzanian government will bring to us gas from Tanzania and Mozambique because our gas resources are not that big. We need gas for fertilizer manufacture, to produce chemicals, etc. Therefore, down with the imperialist parasitic meddlers.
Now, what option do African countries have if Western oil multinationals and financial institutions withdraw from fossil energy projects in Africa?
Western oil multinationals and, you know, the international or Western financial institutions are largely responsible for the current climate catastrophe that Africa and much of the colonized world is experiencing. What African countries need is debt cancellation, any debt cancellation and reparations for the decades, even, you know, centuries of work that these institutions and corporations have done to impoverish African people and intensify that climate catastrophe that they're facing at this moment on the African continent and really throughout the world.
Well, there you have it. Western colonial powers actually owe African countries billions of dollars for crimes they committed against African people over the past centuries. This is the money that Africa needs to develop and attain self-sufficiency. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tunde Osazua, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
تسمع فيها صوت عبد مسلم سجى
قطع مع عذابها بمعصيته وحبس بين أطباقها بجرمه وجريرته وهو يضج إليك ضجيج مؤمل لرحمتك ويناديك بلسان أهل توحيدك ويتوسل إليك بربوبيتك.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. أفتراك سبحانك يا إلهي وبحمدك تسمع فيها صوت عبد مسلم سجن فيها بمخالفته. Can't you see yourself, glory be to you, my Allah, and yours is the praise, hearing within the fire of hell the voice of a slave surrendered to you, imprisoned there because of his violations? وذاق طعم عذابها بمعصيته, suffering the pangs of its torment because of his disobedience. وحبس بين أطباقها بجرمه وجريرته, imprisoned and confined within the levels of fire because of his sin and crime. وهو يضج إليك ضجيج مؤمل لرحمتك, yet he is lamenting before you with the lament of the one hopeful of your mercy. ويناديك بلسان أهل توحيدك, he calls upon you with the tongue of those who profess your oneness. وَيَتَوَسَّلُ إِلَيْكَ بِرُبُوبِيَّتِكَ, he entreats you by your lordship. Imam Ali alayhi salam is reminding us the importance of sins and the role of sins in veiling man from Allah. Yet, of course, the encircling and vast ocean of mercy of the Almighty Allah will cover most of the ones who truly repent, the ones who truly turn back to him from their sins. But Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that the reason this man is confined within the different levels of hellfire is because of his disobedience, is because of his sins and his crimes. Now, we have to know that bad deeds play two roles in man's life. The first role is that they take away man from Allah. They cut him off from him. And as a result, man will not be able to attain the state of turning towards Allah and being mindful of Allah, being in total remembrance of him. Because the reality of supplicating to Allah, the reality of turning to Allah, these two realities are the same. If the sinner is veiled from Allah by his sins, he will surely be veiled by them from supplication as well. Anyway, the second role of the sins is that they prevent the prayer from ascending to Allah. If a prayer reaches Allah, then the response from him would certainly be accomplished. But the point is that the supplication sometimes lacks the ability to reach Allah, because Almighty Allah is neither incapable nor miser. So we must understand that the problem is definitely from the supplication itself. So sometimes sins stop a person from supplicating, and at other times they withhold the ascent of the prayer to Allah. We'll discuss more after a short break.
My Lord, glory and praise be to you. Would you disregard the voice of a Muslim slave imprisoned in hell for his disobedience and imprisoned within its pits for his evil doings and misdeeds? Crying out to you the cries of one who has faith in your mercy, and calling out to you in the language of those who believe in your unity, and seeking to approach you by means of your epithet.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable. Knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, we said that Imam Ali alayhi salam in this part of the supplication is mentioning that the man, that the servant of the Almighty Allah, is confined within the levels of the hellfire because of his own sins, because of his disobedience and his crime. سُجِنَ فِيهَا بِمُخَالَفَتِهِ, this part says. ذَاقَطَ عَذَابِهَا بِمَعْصِيَتِهِ. He is imprisoned because of his violations. He's suffering the torment because of his disobedience. And he is confined within its levels because of his sins and crimes. Now, the general idea and concept that we need to be aware of, if we truly want our supplications to be accepted, if we want that our calls to Allah would be responded, we need to know that there are some obstacles and hindrances in the way. Now, the Islamic narrations suggest that one of the most significant factors that lead to the obscurity of the heart is committing sins and disregard of the Almighty Allah. For example, the Holy Quran says that when our signs are recited to him, he turns away disdainfully, as if he had not heard them at all, as if there were a deafness in his ears. Now, when we notice, we understand that this verse has a mutual relation between disregard for the signs of Allah and being disdainful of them, and the deafness of the ears. And also, regarding our discussion, our focal point is this verse of the Holy Quran. Rather, their hearts have been sullied by what they have been earning. This verse of the Holy Quran, dear listeners, clearly implies that the sins committed by a person evolve until the man becomes full of rust and dirt in the heart. And this is what is cutting it off from the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio, Coming up is the news.